The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and the New Statesman's political editor Stephen Bush. When Keir Starmer took over from Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader, there were questions as to what exactly he would bring to the role. He spent much of the leadership campaign not going into specifics on his opinions, yet managing to unite a broad base when it came to Labour supporters. So, now with several weeks under his belt, how is he getting on? Stephen, in recent weeks, I think it's fair to say that Keir Starmer's won many compliments for his performance at Prime Minister's Questions. I think in advance of him becoming Labour leader, it was definitely something the Tories were worried about because they see him as forensic in detail, something that Boris Johnson is not. Do you think that he has proven this to be the case with his free outings now against the Prime Minister?
Yeah, well, I think in an odd way, right, we've kind of had so far a set of PMQs almost laboratory designed to demonstrate the thing we already knew Keir Starmer was going to be good at in PMQs, right? In that I think everyone acknowledges that the government has made some mistakes, particularly, well, I guess it's more of a question about the British state overall, but particularly about care homes. And ultimately, PMQs are primarily lost outside the chamber. And at the moment, it would be quite hard, I think, for any prime minister in these circumstances to win them. A prime minister who, again, I think everyone acknowledges is not a details person. What we kind of still don't know, because he hasn't had to demonstrate this yet, is Keir Starmer someone who can use these to construct a narrative or a set of dividing lines and allow him to win an election as opposed to merely discomforting the government? I think so far he's proved he's someone who can discomfort the government. What he hasn't proved yet, I kind of think about something someone once said to me about Ed Miliband immediately before the election, where this was someone on the Conservative side, and they said, well, the thing about Ed is a lot of the weeks were pretty awful for us, but I don't think any of the months were. And I think we don't yet know whether or not Keir is someone who can deliver not just awful weeks, but awful months for the government.
James, as well as an ability to scrutinise the Prime Minister with a set of questions, something which perhaps was seemed to be more lacking in the previous Labour leader, what Keir Starmer does seem to be able to do is to work out fights that he thinks he's going to win and then go with those. So one example this week, and perhaps the most obvious, is the NHS migrant surcharge. We had a situation where Keir Starmer brought it up with the Prime Minister at PMQs. The Prime Minister replied defending it, but then within 24 hours, numbers had rode back on it and have waived their fee for care workers and health workers. So does that show that Keir Starmer is good at spotting political battles?
So I think there is an irony here, which is everyone declared that of the three PMQs he's had against Boris Johnson, this week was the most disappointing for Keir Starmer. But it's actually the week where he forced the government to change policy. Now, I suspect that if you're going to U-turn, U-turn early. And I suspect Boris Johnson U-turned quickly enough not to accumulate that much political damage from this decision. But the thing I would say about Keir Starmer is he does, and again, in some ways, part of the problem is that Jeremy Corbyn is so low at the bar that we are amazed when anyone does basically sensible things. But one of the things he's quite adept at is working out to how to package messages to the audience he wants to reach. Probably the most spectacular example of that was his piece for the Telegraph on VE Day about care homes, saying, you know, we can't treat the veterans of World War II like this, so the government need to get a grip on the situation in care homes. And I mean, you saw something similar on this NHS surcharge, which is, what's the way to make a pro-immigration argument that pleases my Liberal base in a way that also seems fair to voters in Stoke-on-Trent North? And I thought that was cleverly done. Personally, I mean, the most impressive thing that Keir Starmer has done is everything he does suggests that he realises that oppositions don't win elections, governments lose them. And I think what he is doing is adopting quite a cautious approach. He's created a shadow cabinet in his own image. It's not the most exciting shadow cabinet in the world, but it has a kind of mild whiff of competence about it. One Tory I was talking to said, you know, we're not going to be able to go round the city in 2024 and tell people that if you don't donate to the Tory party, Annalise Dodds will be will be Chancellor of the Exchequer, and a kind of fear will run through the room. So I think that insight, that given Labour's electoral predicament right now, his best approach is to not take spectacular positions, but instead to chip away at the government on competence and execution, as he is seeking to do on the coronavirus and the lockdown, is the best route forward for him.
Stephen, I have one Tory MP this week discuss how Boris Johnson in their mind wasn't faring particularly well at Prime Minister's questions. But I said, in a way, this was priced in. Boris Johnson was never going to be the perfect person for this on detail, and Keir Starmer clearly would be able to exploit that. But I made the point that they weren't particularly worried about this, because ultimately we've had lots of people who were good at Prime Minister's questions as opposition leader who never became Prime Minister. They mentioned William Hague. So do you think perhaps we can focus too much on these performances as a sign of the electability of a leader?
I think PMQ's main useful value is that they are a stress test for the government and the opposition, right? So PMQ's in its modern form has two creators: Margaret Thatcher, who basically was the one who first announced, "I will take all of these questions," rather than occasionally shunting them off to other departments. And she used it very effectively as an accountability mechanism of the departments to herself, right? She basically used it as a way of going, "I've had four questions about health, which I haven't been able to have a good answer to. When am I going to get these improvements on waiting times?" And then its other kind of co-creator is Tony Blair, who turned it from 2 15-minute sessions to 1 half-an-hour or longer session of 6 of questions from the Leader of the Opposition, as opposed to 3. Now, in many ways, it doesn't matter if every couple of weeks, if the Leader of the Opposition, more weeks than you win, is cleaning your clock, because the Leader of the Opposition can pick their ground. They can choose the questions. Yes, the Prime Minister has the advantage and they have the machinery of the government and the last word. But for example, to take, and I think James is exactly right about the cleverness of this particular issue, right? In PMQs, the Leader of the Opposition can choose to fight on issues like immigration, in very narrow questions on which Labour is stronger than the Conservatives. In an election, you are fighting across the whole gamut of immigration policy, and the outcome of that is less congenial for the Labour Party as it stands. Where I think it does matter a bit is then why is a Prime Minister winning or losing, and what does that reveal? Why was John Major mostly losing PMQs to Tony Blair? Because his party was irretrievably divided, and bitterly so. That obviously matters more than why was William Hague winning a lot of PMQs? Because they were the central aspect of his week. They did lots of clever things to discomfort him in the chamber, but broadly, he was not building a particularly strong political argument. And I think the thing that the kind of cosmic bet of Boris Johnson's premiership is our traditionally underpowered centre of government capable of sustaining a successful Boris Johnson premiership in the way that the institutions of City Hall were capable of sustaining a successful Boris Johnson mayoralty? And in many ways, the thing we're seeing day to day is the reason why Keir has won these exchanges so far is, A, because of the operational difficulties, but also things like, say, why are we leaving as four nations, not one, where Keir Starmer is just wrong and the government's exit strategy is just exactly right about why you do have variations within regions. The reason why Boris Johnson was unable to make that argument in a way, say, David Cameron would have done is because he's not on top of it. And that is where I think it possibly does matter if it turns out you can't run Downing Street in the City Hall model. You do end up with a government with a reputation for incompetence, failure to deliver on key manifesto objectives. But I guess it's just all that's come back to the central point James makes about governments losing elections. So I guess PMQs is revealing, but it doesn't necessarily reveal something that means you can win an election.
James, how do you think Number 10 are finding Keir Starmer as opponent? We did see this week that there were as many Tory MPs as you could pack into a socially distanced chamber for Boris Johnson to speak, and, you know, tried to make supportive noises, which was a change in tack.
Yeah, I think one of the big things that social distancing in the Commons does is it knocks out the governing party's traditional advantage at PMQs, which is you just have more people to shout down the leader of the opposition. You know, people don't like people saying that, but that is just the brute reality. I think one other thing that has helped Keir Starmer is the current time is not a time for levity. And Boris Johnson is an entertainer politician. But you can't, you know, that skill is not much use when you are discussing a weekly death toll, which is hideously high. I think the number 10 view on Keir Starmer is that they actually have an opposition who is going to keep them on their toes, you know. For example, right, to take the NHS surcharge point that, you know, you wrote the blog about this, Katie. What forced Boris Johnson to change his opinion was, I think your analysis is correct on this, is more what Tory MPs were saying than what Keir Starmer was saying at PMQs. If Jeremy Corbyn had asked those questions, Jeremy Corbyn would have done it as in, you are wicked to want any controls on immigration. That is an immoral position. It was the fact that Keir Starmer shaped the question in a way that made it most politically potent, rather than trying to prove his left-wing bona fides or virtue signal, that made it so effective. Because he said, look, he didn't attack the whole principle of asking immigrants from non-EEA countries to pay an extra charge for their use of the NHS. He attacked it for those who work in the healthcare sector. And it was that narrowness of the attack that made it successful. Whereas I think Jeremy Corbyn would have tried to make a much bigger moral argument, and it actually would have ended up packing much less punch for that reason.
And finally, Stephen, we've spoken rather positively about the Labour leader on this podcast. So I was wondering, do you think there's anything where he has got it wrong so far, where Keir Starmer has, you know, made the wrong decision?
Well, so from a policy perspective, I think that we must leave as one united nation. Just it doesn't make any sense as a critique. And I think ultimately oppositions are very rarely rewarded in the long term for critiques which don't make any sense, right? So if anything, right, there's a stronger argument to criticise all four of the devolved governments, and it is not clear why we have a situation in which you still have to socially distance in Orkney, which has no cases, and you can't get to from any other part of Scotland, let alone anywhere else in the world, or why you would necessarily want to reopen schools on the same timetable in the same method in London, which has a lower R rate than other parts of the country. I kind of think the other thing he's potentially getting wrong, though, is that we forget the Leader of the Opposition has two roles. Their really important kind of constitutional function, which is to improve the quality of the government, right? I think there are lots of reasons why we have been less effectively governed since 2015, in the last half of the decade, than we were in the first. Some of them are about the loss of many capable Lib Dem ministers, the fact David Cameron was a very effective Prime Minister in a way that Theresa May was not. But I think another reason was that you lost having a leader of the opposition who was good at improving the effectiveness of the government through scrutiny. Now, the weird thing, of course, is that in an odd way, if you're the leader of the opposition, you want to scrutinise the government just enough that people think you'd be a good Prime Minister, but not so much that the government improves and therefore remains the government. And in an odd way, the big question I think then we still have about Keir Starmer is he going to be an Ed Miliband-style leader of the opposition who improves the quality of government but doesn't replace it?
I think when Keir Starmer got this job, there was a lot of debate about whether he was going to struggle because the pandemic made it very hard for him to get news coverage. You know, lots of people say, oh, look at Ian Duncan Smith. He became Tory leader straight after 9/11, and he basically never had that opportunity to introduce himself to the public. I think what we've seen in a way is we've now got a moment that in some ways is quite politically suited to Keir Starmer. He's bedding himself in at PMQs with quite an empty chamber. There are lots of bits of government advice that he can dig into in his lawyerly style. And I think the bigger question, which we haven't seen yet, the big question about Keir Starmer is, can he forge an emotional connection with voters? And that, I think, is the big issue for him. Can he create a sense that some of these voters, the 30% of Labour 2005 voters that have gone to the Tories, can Keir Starmer create an emotional connection with them? That's what we haven't seen any evidence of yet.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Stephen.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.